and detain them without trial for as long as 3 years.
I'm out to sing songs that'll prove to you that this is your world, and that if it's hit you pretty hard and knocked you down for a dozen loops, no matter how hard it's run you down and rolled over you, no matter what color, what size you are, how you're built, I am out to sing the songs that'll make you take pride in yourself.
I'm Lori Sonnenfeld.
And I'm Don Jacobson.
Together we bring you Moving On, Fridays from 12 noon to 1:30.
We feature both traditional and contemporary folk music.
We love to present live in-studio concerts from local and national musicians.
Tune in and you'll hear music that is socially progressive, moving, and heartfelt.
Music heard only on the left-hand edge of the dial and only on KBOO.
Every Friday, noon to 1:30.
We who believe in freedom cannot
Interested in solar power? In saving the planet and money on your electricity bill? In creating millions of good jobs? Celebrate the just-completed solar power electricity installation at the Musicians Union Hall on Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 7 p.m. You'll have a chance to see the rooftop solar unit. Learn about how you can do it on your home or business. There will be food, children's games, displays, and lots of music from the likes of Dave Rovix. Again, that's Sunday, August 17th, from 3 to 7 p.m. at the Musicians Union Hall, 320 Northeast 20th in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Again, sun is on my face, solar panels in place, catching solar rays.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 11:01 a.m. Coming up next is a special edition of The Digital Divide, a program by Radio Curious about the impact the internet has on our memory and our ability to forget, with Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. Keep it locked right here for Radio Curious. And then at noon, the KBOO News at noon, followed by Moving On. Stay tuned.
Welcome to the archives of Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. What is the importance that forgetting has played throughout human history? What will be the effects on society, relationships, and humanity now that so many aspects of our lives are digitally preserved? Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age, and our guest in this archive edition of Radio Curious, has some insights into these questions. He argues that the capacity for eternal memory can have unanticipated and often unwanted consequences. The potentially humiliating content on Facebook, forever enshrined in cyberspace, and Google's search memory of the content and time of all our online searches may in the future reveal portions of our past we have entirely forgotten and would wish everyone else had too. In these two Radio Curious visits with Victor Meyer-Schoenberger, we explore some of the ways in which our personal information, data, conversations, and experiences are forgotten by us as individuals. We also consider the future potential effects on society of digitally preserved information, as well as the consequences of remembering what is sometimes best forgotten. Victor Meyer-Schoenberger spoke with us by phone from his then home in Singapore on January 4th, 2010. And began our conversation by describing how the digital age is shifting the brain's balance between remembering and forgetting.
This is perhaps one of the most profound shifts in recent times for most of human history, humans by default forgot most of what they experienced in their daily lives. It took an effort for them to remember, to keep and hold on to experiences, ideas that they felt were important to them. And it was very easy for them to forget because forgetting was built into them, built into our brains. The digital age has reversed that default. Today, it is very easy for us to remember. In fact, it has become the default. And forgetting has gotten expensive.
However, what is remembered is what has been converted into a digital form of preservation. Our conversation, for instance, I'm recording on a computer and it will be on our website. But in an unrecorded conversation, what we say to each other would not necessarily be remembered by default in that fashion.
That is absolutely right. This is another problem of the digital age in the sense that what is remembered is not a comprehensive record of our lives, but is biased towards what can be digitally recorded and then later digitally accessed. So what we remember today, what future generations will know about us, is not what we decide we want to have remembered, but what the digital devices that we use today by default can capture and remember. So oral conversations that we have will remain ephemeral, will not be captured, while what we have as a permanent record is what digital devices capture for us, mostly written text, but more and more video and audio as well.
Well, then, the common experience of having a private conversation goes by the wayside, and what we remember is determined by those who choose to submit it for capture, submissions of what somebody might buy on the internet from Amazon, for example, or submit in a blog.
That is true, and a lot of times we don't even know. It's not clear to us and transparent to us that something is being captured. For example, search engines, including most popularly Google, capture every search query that is sent to them and also remember every search result users click on. And for quite a number of months, they associate personal identifiable data with that, so they can trace it back to a particular human being. That means that Google knows more about our search behavior and our search patterns that we ourselves remember. Google receives about a billion plus search requests a day and still remembers every one of them 9 months later. In fact, they remember every one of them years and years later. They just forget, quote unquote, some of the personal identifiers, which means that Google knows and remembers stuff that most people don't understand, don't realize Google actually has the capacity to remember.
You say they remember it personally to you or me or anybody who uses a computer. How is that? I can understand how they remember it to a specific computer, but how about a public computer?
Well, there's a number of ways by which this can be done. First, Google, through its Google Mail services and Google Calendar services and all the other services that they offer, including Google Docs, asks members to log in. And when you remain logged in and then search, they know who you are. So that's the most easy and clearest. But even if you don't do that, and if you use a public computer, just by the way you search, by the cookies you have, by the IP address you use, by how you search, they are able to link back to you relatively well. There is some uncertainty on the edges, but by and large, most people keep using their own computers, whether they're laptops or smartphones, or their desktop computers from home to search. and don't shift and change computers a lot of times. So in that sense, even if you're not logged into Google services, Google still has a very good way of finding out who you are. There is a wonderful little vignette for the power of search to identify human beings. A few years back, AOL, a totally different service, published a couple of 100,000 search records, and they said that they had taken away all of the personal identifiers. And a journalist, I believe it was from the New York Times, looked at the search records, and just by the way the search records were revealing demographic information, tried to identify a human being, and it was actually relatively easy. He could identify one woman from Atlanta, Georgia, and he called her up and said, "Do you know that AOL just released your search records, and they said that they took away the personal information, but I was able to identify you, and now I know what you searched. Are you comfortable with that?" And of course, she wasn't, surprisingly. And I think that is probably true for the vast variety, a vast majority of folks.
That lack of comfort is something that most people are unaware that exists. I'd like to direct our conversation, if I may, towards what happened about 100 years ago when the default for transportation was to go by foot or go by horse. And then it shifted to go by an automobile, auto in that it's self-mobile, gasoline-powered, and the change that has come throughout our world in the past 100 years. Taking the concept of the inversion of remembering versus forgetting, what predictions do you see in 20, 50 to 100 years of that inversion on the human brain, the human society?
Well, when we look at the importance of forgetting in a society and in individuals, the importance of our capacity to let bygone be bygone, the thought that comes immediately to our mind is the importance of forgetting as a measure, as a way to ensure privacy, individual privacy. And authors around the world over the last maybe two decades have predicted that if we take away our ability to forget, we create a society that will behave like what Jeremy Bentham called the panopticon, basically a prison in which the prisoners must assume that they're constantly watched, although they don't know whether they're being watched or not. And because they have to assume that they're being watched all the time, they behave accordingly. And so in a panopticon, Bentham said, in a panoptic prison, a very small number of guards can control a very large number of prisoners, and they all behave because they have to assume that they are constantly being watched, so to self-censor themselves. Authors around the world have argued that in internet times, we have moved towards a global panopticon in which everybody on the internet can watch everybody else's YouTube videos and blog entries and Flickr photographs and Facebook status messages and so forth. So we have created a global information panopticon. But there is a wrinkle to that, I think, and the wrinkle is that because the data remains accessible, not just for weeks, but for months and years, even decades, we have not only created a global panopticon, we have created what I call a temporal panopticon. That is a capacity to not just watch in the present, but to watch what people have done in the past. And so if people realize that, they become self-censoring. President Obama in September advised school children to watch themselves, what they say or do on the internet, because it might come to haunt them in years or decades into the future when they apply for a job, for example, which means basically that he told them, be careful and self-censor what you do on the internet. Now, that's helpful advice, except that it means that if we self-censor, it impoverishes the tools of communications that we have available to us, and it impoverishes what I believe is an important element of our society, namely robust public debate.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Victor Mayer Schoenberger from his home in Singapore. He's the author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age, and we're discussing what can be anticipated in the next 20, 50, or 100 years, now that the concept of remembering versus forgetting has been inverted. Victor, you raised some interesting issues there. Self-censor impoverishes what you mentioned, but also creativity.
That is true. And that leads me to a second, perhaps to me, even more troubling challenge of comprehensive memory. Privacy is an important element, but when I went into this research, I discovered that our ability to forget actually plays an even more important and central role into our ability to make sense of our existence, of reality, of life. Because humans, by forgetting, also are able to abstract and generalize from their experiences something that they keep and hold on to into the future. And if we lose our ability to forget, we also lose our ability to generalize and to abstract, to see the forest rather than just trees. And if we stop having the ability to forget, then we might forever be steeped into the details of our past rather than be able to rise above that and to act in the present and to look into the future. Unlearning, forgetting, is centrally important, an important element to creativity, to the ability to move forward, to have new thoughts and new ideas. And if we do away with the ability to forget through digital tools, for example, of remembering, then we impede upon our capacity as individuals as well as society to innovate, to be creative, and to move forward. And that, to me, is the second and more troubling challenge that comprehensive digital memory poses.
Can you give us some examples of how having access or the inability to forget impedes us?
Yes. There's a very intriguing story emerging from cognitive science through the study of what is called comprehensive digital memory in some people who cannot forget. There's a woman in California by the name of AJ who, for biological reasons, it seems, has difficulties forgetting. So you can ask her about a particular day 30 years ago, and she's able to tell you when she woke up, what she did in the morning, what was on television, who called, and what was on the newspaper for every day the last 30 years. So she has difficulties forgetting. Now, we would assume that she would enjoy that capacity. After all, she knew exactly where she left her car keys, parked her car. But the truth of the fact is that she is not seeing her ability to comprehensively remember her past as a benefit, but as a curse. For her, all of her past failed decisions are constantly present, and as she describes it, inhibit and limit and constrain her ability to act in time, that is, to act and decide in the present. And so an ever more overbearing past then limits her ability to live and be able to act in the present. And this is what we may face in a world in which the digital tools around us, by default, record most of our utterances and keep that record for many years and decades available, not just to us, but potentially to the rest of the world.
Well, considering the malleability of the human brain in relationship to perhaps fax machines, 25 years ago they weren't available as they are now, and now they're falling aside to being able to send a document on a computer, perhaps with a confirmed signature.
Yes.
Do you see ways of a malleability of the human brain in the future so that digital memory can be separated from the ability to forget, and notwithstanding that we have access to all this information, we still may be able to make rational decisions?
You know, this is a very important element of the equation, because our human brain is beautiful, malleable in the sense that we can adjust our preferences and values. In fact, we do that all the time. Over time, our preferences and values do change. So 100 years ago or 150 years ago, we all held different values. We were much less concerned about equality or about gender parity, universal suffrage, and so forth. Today, we have different values, and we cherish these values very much. So the question is, can we have a value adjustment that lets us deal with comprehensive digital memory, just like we had a value adjustment that lets us deal with equality or general suffrage and so forth? The problem is that comprehensive digital memory confronts us not with a need to adjust a value, that is, to devalue the past or whatever, but it confronts us with the need to adjust the way by which humans process and weigh information. And that is much harder to do. We can adjust values, but it is extremely hard for us human beings to rewire our brains so that we process information differently. And so I don't see a fast-paced way for us humans to adjust quickly to a world of comprehensive digital memory. This rewiring that would be necessary to do that would take, I believe, many generations and hundreds of years.
That presents a pretty huge conundrum.
It does. And yet I believe that the key to solve the riddle is with us as well, because what is eminently malleable, much more malleable than the human brain, is in fact the digital devices that surround us. So what I suggest in the book, what we need to do is to revive the importance of forgetting and build forgetting into the digital devices that we have and that we utilize, much like it is built into our human brain.
Victor Mayer Schoenberger, author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. Let's hold off, if we can, for our second interview, a second conversation about how we can adjust the digital devices so that we can enhance forgetting, which to some may be an oxymoron. And stay for a little bit with the way we process information now and the importance of forgetting. And in doing so, I'd like to reference what you mentioned going back about 500 years to when the Catholic Church had significant control over written manuscripts. 50 or so years before Gutenberg created the movable type printing press, Cambridge University Library in England, you mentioned, had 122 books. Within 50 years after the invention of the movable type press, there were about 8 million. And you conclude that the control over memory was slipping from the church's hands. It seemed like that was almost an equally significant shift of the control of knowledge that we are now entering into.
Yes, I'd say that's true. The Catholic Church, for quite a number of centuries, held almost total control over a lot of the recorded information in the Western world at that time, and that slipped from its hands around the time of the introduction of the movable type and the translation of the Bible into the vernacular. today we may be witnessing a similar shift in the sense that control over recorded information is slipping from the hands of us individuals and might be re-centralized, might be moving towards a relatively small number of organizations or institutions. Just imagine the enormous amount of information that Google, for example, is controlling through Google Books, the search data that they have, the control over YouTube and the photographs through Picasa and other tools that they have available, through the control over mail through Google Mail and so forth. So there is a re-centralization, if you want, of control.
And that control is no longer in the lap of the person who sits next to someone to whom they're showing a photo or sent to them privately through the postal system.
Not at all. In fact, what happens if I may use the term privatize and re-centralize information control is that if we fail to remember in our brains what happened in our past, we go back to our digital records, we revisit the digital documents, the photographs, the videos that we have kept and stored. But we keep and store this not anymore in the future in our computers, but in centralized computers of large information providers like Google. That means that Google now controls the ability to not just supply us with that information, but to also potentially alter that information and therefore alter human memory.
Well, that's the conversation of our next visit with Victor Mayer Schoenberger on Radio Curious. And before we close this one, Victor, can you tell us about a eureka moment or an aha moment that's come to you recently?
Yes, I was on book tour promoting Delete in the United States. And I was doing a radio interview like this, and I was, of course, always curious about stories of memory and so forth. And there was this woman calling in and telling me about her inability to move on, restart a new life after having done some stupid things in her youth, because her mugshot from having been in prison suddenly reappeared on the internet through a new commercial service that puts online all the mugshots of prisoners in the state of California, you know, way back, 10, 20 years back. And when she told me the story, and then she posed a question of saying, so what am I going to do about this? How can I protect myself from my past, from a person that has long vanished? I was looking at it and I said, God, I have never thought about that particular side of it. And there is another whole dimension of the problem that I have completely missed and that might be even more troubling. And so I had this moment, I guess, of revelation that I probably need to write a sequel to Delete.
And can you tell us about an interesting book that you would recommend?
Yes, I would very much recommend what is called collected stories or collected fiction of Jorge Luis Borges, a fiction writer, short story writer from Argentina, who in the 60s, 70s wrote wonderful short stories that encapsulate the paradoxes and complexities of modern lives. He has a wonderful story about memory and remembering, but he also has other interesting stories, paradox conundrums. These paradox questions permeate his short stories. They are wonderful vignettes, and I highly recommend them.
Well, Victor Mayer Schoenberger, author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age, thank you for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you very much, Barry, for having me.
Victor Mayer Schoenberger is the author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. The book that Victor Mayer Schoenberger recommends is Collected Fictions by José Luis Borges. I'm Barry Vogel. In this, the second of a two-part archived conversation with Victor Mayer Schoenberger, professor of internet governance and regulation at Oxford University in the United Kingdom, and author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age, we discuss methods by which people may protect themselves from revealing personal information online and how personal information may be deleted. Delete asserts that the capacity for eternal memory can have unanticipated and often unwanted consequences. With Victor Mayer Schoenberger, we explore ways in which our personal information, data, conversations, and experiences are forgotten by us as individuals, but remembered digitally. We consider the future potential effects on society of digitally preserved information, as well as the consequences of remembering what is sometimes best forgotten. Victor Mayer Schoenberger joined us by phone from his then home in Singapore on January 4th, 2010. We began the second part of our conversation by discussing how to digitally delete personal information so it is no longer available.
Well, as I argue in the book, my suggestion is that we, rather than creating new laws or new social rules or hope to rewire our human brains, we focus on creating digital artifacts, creating digital tools that enable and have built in the capacity to forget. Much as we humans have the capacity to forget, we should surround us, I argue in the book, with tools and techniques that are well aligned with forgetting, because forgetting plays such a central role to our existence and to human consciousness.
Those tools, the ones with which we align ourselves, are?
Well, take digital cameras, take our computers. If you go back 20, 30 years to the world of analog cameras, people would be very careful in what picture they would take, because each picture they would take would cost a small but not a trivial amount of money to develop and then to take a look at. So people chose carefully what kind of image they would take. With digital cameras, that's not the case anymore. In fact, digital storage is so cheap these days that we just take pictures whenever we want, hundreds of them, even thousands. And then we connect our digital image capturing device, our digital camera, to our computer. And what's happening then is that our software, by default, automatically uploads all of the pictures onto our hard drives. We don't select pictures that we want to have stored and saved and remembered, and those that we want to have forgotten and therefore discarded and deleted, because it's just too tiring and too cumbersome for us to do that. The default is remembering, and the default is built into the digital devices we use, and that's what we are doing. I suggest we reverse that. I suggest that we create digital tools that let us forget and forget more easily. One way to do that is through what I call expiration dates of information. So I suggest that whenever we store something, we have an expiration date assigned to it.
When we assign the expiration date, are you suggesting that that be of all of the photos that perhaps some of us have uploaded to our computer, or selected ones?
What I suggest is that whenever we store an image, we select how long we want that image to be kept on our computer, so that when we upload images, we very quickly go through them, and with the click of a button and some intuitive user interface, we can select whether this is such a great photograph that we want to keep it forever, that is, we want to keep it for the next 100 years or 200 years or 500 years, or whether this is an okay photo and we just want to keep it for the next 3 to 5 years because we may or may not use it, or whether this is just a photo that we really don't need at all because it's shaky, because we didn't catch anybody in a nice pose in there, and therefore give us back the choice, the gradated choice that we need to have the real ability to remember and to forget in the digital age. Today, we can only decide whether we want to upload or not. In the future, I suggest we need to have the ability to decide how long we want to preserve a particular image. Of course, the success of that depends on our ability to create a user experience, a software tools that are easy to use and easy to handle, perhaps with useful presets and defaults that make it very easy for us to choose how long we want to preserve something.
You're also asking people to do a little bit more than just upload the pictures or set them for upload and then go off and do something else and come back a little while later. You're asking them to go through each picture and classify the ones they wish to save in how long they should be, permanent or be gone after a set time. That's an affirmative act that I can figure many people might not want to do.
There's two reasons why we should, nevertheless, do it. One is that if we remember by default, we expose ourselves to all the potential threats and evils of a comprehensive digital memory. Secondly, by making us consider how long we want to preserve something and when we want to have something deleted or forgotten, even if it only takes a second or two of consideration, it means that we as human beings are reminded of the contextuality of information, that is, of the fact that information is not valid forever, but most information is connected to and linked to a particular point in time, a particular context, and loses its value over time. Most of the information that we have available today isn't particularly helpful or useful maybe 30, 40 years into the future and can be forgotten at that time. Let me tell a quick personal story. My stepfather passed away earlier this year and I inherited a huge library of photographs. In fact, in the last couple of years, he has shot digital images and he has kept thousands and thousands of them. And we went through them and I had a very simple rule. I would keep every photograph that had a person in it that I would know. And out of the 4,000-some digital images that I went through one afternoon, there were four images that I would keep. And so that, to me, goes to show that much of what we capture can actually be forgotten with very little value loss.
Well, that goes back to something that we mentioned in our last conversation about prior to the movable type press, what was saved of images were those which people with substantial economic means could have someone create of themselves or a view that they liked. The others only had the image that was engraved in their personal memory.
And buried in the future, it might be the other way around. In the future, it might be that those that are affluent, those with significant means, have the ability to delete the pictures, to delete the memory that they no longer want or they no longer need, while most of us will not be able to do that. There are already services out there on the internet that help people to delete the information that is available to the rest of the world about them, that they don't want to have deleted. Reputation Defender is one of them, for example. So that means that in the future, forgetting is going to be a luxury good.
Well, we're talking in a sense about a boundary here. One is keeping personal information on a home computer, and two is requiring laws or a system of software that would be imposed on the external computers. Google is the primary example that we've been using, that would delete it over a period of time. It's crossing that boundary that gets us into the area of the surveyors keeping the information, as you characterize it in the conclusion of your book, as opposed of those people being surveyed keeping the information.
That is true. I would like to see an ability to have expiration dates for digital images that would then be honored even if I uploaded to, let's say, Flickr or another of those photo services. So that when I select an expiration date, let's say 6 months into the future, 6 months into the future, Flickr will delete that photograph from its image database. And so I want online services to honor the expiration dates that individuals set for their own images.
I think we have some interesting concepts here between who sets the rules and who implements them and follows up to determine if those rules or laws are in fact implemented. And before we get to that, I'd like to say that in this edition of Radio Curious, we're talking with Victor Mayer Schoenberger, the author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. This is Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Victor, what are your considerations of the way we can get the controllers of this information, the keepers of this information, to follow the laws that would say delete after X period of time?
Well, Barry, on the internet, there is a relatively simple rule, and that is that the cost that users incur in switching from one service to the other is relatively low. Experts call that a lack of stickiness of customers to a particular service. And that means that if customers are unhappy with a particular service, let's say with a search engine that they use or with a photo service that they use, they can switch to an alternate service relatively easily. So we as consumers, that is, we as customers on the internet, have a lot of power available to us. And we can choose to exercise that power based on our preferences and our values. So I suggest that if we don't like a particular service because it's not valuing the information that we provide to it, that is, it is not following the expiration date idea, it is keeping information longer than we want it to keep our information, then we should switch to a different service. It is a market out there, and we should make use of the choice and the choices that the market provides.
Making use of the market that is provided reminds me of our first conversation about the psychological analyses that can be created about each user through the agencies or the organizations that collect this information and thus market it to us in a way that benefits them economically from one perspective. From another perspective, young people who soon will be having full internet access through their cell phones, if they don't already, may not give a hoot about whether what they say is remembered or not, and may in fact want it remembered.
Or not. They may just not realize that what they put on Facebook is being remembered. What they say on Twitter is being remembered for a long period of time. It seems to me that in particular with IM, with Facebook, with Twitter, a lot of the digital natives, the younger generation of internet users, approach these tools as tools of enabling and digital equivalent of ephemeral oral communication. Small little snippets that are exchanged are very similar to what you would say to somebody who you bump into on the street. It's ephemeral communication. The problem is that, of course, when we use digital tools, it's not ephemeral. It doesn't go away. It is being kept. And quite frankly, those that understand that, those that perhaps have received the short end of the stick, have been feeling the detriment of digital memory. For example, by losing their jobs or losing a relationship because of what they said on Facebook or Twitter, even those digital natives very clearly understand the power and the threat of comprehensive digital memory. So I don't think the younger generation is oblivious or ignorant to it.
What are your thoughts on the ability to psychologically analyze a computer user based on the historical analysis of their use?
A lot of internet services that are driven by ad revenues, that is, that are based on a business model that uses ad income as its main source, think that using user-generated information from past transactions, from past interactions, whether they're book purchases on Amazon or browsing behavior or search requests sent to Google, that they can use this information to understand a person better. That may be true to an extent, but there is also a huge danger to that, and that is that by putting all these puzzle pieces of information together, what we do is not recreating a person that exists and lives in the present, but what we are doing is recreating a person that never lived, that is an amalgamation of pieces from 10 years ago and 5 years ago and 5 months ago and 5 days ago of a person that over time changes, like we all do, values and preferences. But the image, the digital image that is being conjured, doesn't capture that change because it captures just the summary of all of our preferences of the last decade or two. And that is what I find particularly troubling of those comprehensive information aggregators on the internet. They have no sense of time and change, and therefore what they provide others, what they provide third parties with about me and about other individuals is not what we as individuals think about today, what our preferences and values are today, but what they were perhaps 5 years ago or 10 years ago. And that has nothing to do with the human being that I am today.
You make reference to that in George Orwell's 1984 in your chapter entitled Of Power and Time. And you actually go on a little bit about the possibility of the day-to-day falsification of the past.
That is right. As much as we entrust others to be the keepers of our digital records of our own past, that is, the keepers of our memory, we also entrust them with being truthful and comprehensive with our memory. That is a lot of power entrusted to a small set of providers, and therefore they also, at least in theory, have the ability to change the records that they have available. There is no guarantee that what we find on Google is comprehensive, complete, or authentic. Although most of the time these days, when we search for information, we Google something or we look it up in Wikipedia. But we don't realize that there is, again, no guarantee for this information record that we are being presented with that this is comprehensive or authentic or in any form or shape true.
If that is a given, how would you suggest that those organizations or aggregators of this information be controlled? This question has the inherent assumption that nations or governmental alliances would establish laws that would require certain deletion over a period of time. How could they be controlled to delete?
Well, first of all, I think a significant amount of that challenge may actually go away just by the sheer fact that if users like you and me realize the power of Google, the power of these online services, we might exercise more discretion and we might choose the online providers that we use more carefully. And in that sense, these online providers themselves will be forced through market pressure to comply with certain corporate governance rules, to comply with our desire to be able to choose what needs to be remembered and what ought to be forgotten. But to the extent that that is not happening, not going to happen, we may need, under certain circumstances, some rules, some new laws of information privacy, of the ability to give us individuals back the choice of remembering and forgetting, of choosing what in the future we want to have remembered about ourselves and what we want to have forgotten. And we might need those laws in particular circumstances, and these laws may need to be put in place in a number of Western countries to be comprehensive. But I do believe that, let's take the United States, Canada, and Europe, that there is a significant consensus of the importance of the informational privacy online in particular, and the importance of forgetting. So I don't think that this is a hurdle that cannot be taken.
Well, when you say United States, Canada, and Europe, there's a greater commonality of thinking processes among those groups than there might be in other areas where members of society are expected to behave within the confines or the dictates of that society.
Yes.
So my question is, how can the requirement to delete after a period of time, the requirement to forget, be enforced either within the confines of Western thought or extending it beyond that to non-Western thought?
Well, first of all, my suggestion is not to have a strict law that would say after a certain period of time, certain information has to be forgotten. On the contrary, what I want is a law that enables us to choose when to forget and when to remember. So the choice is with us. And with respect to the enforcement wouldn't be through a deletion sheriff or something like that. The enforcement would rest upon our ability to see and to understand what the information providers out there are doing and whether they are complying or not. It seems to me that that pressure are doing and whether they are complying or not, it seems to me that that pressure, that consumer pressure of compliance is going to take care of maybe 80 or 90% of the problem. In fact, after having made the suggestion of digital forgetting over the last 2 years, I was surprised to learn about a number of online services out there that already exist that enable exactly that kind of choice of forgetting or remembering that I talked about. So there are search engines out there like ask.com that permits you to delete your search history with a simple mouse click. There is online services out there like drop.io where you can share photos and files with each other, but you can adjust, you can attach an expiration date and adjust, therefore, the length of time that that information stays online. And these services, by and large, are doing pretty well. And that tells me that consumers out there value that type of service because that conforms to their preferences and values and the importance of forgetting.
Well, Victor Mayer Schoenberger, author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age, this is fascinating, and I hope that in the future we can remember to visit again. And before we close, is there perhaps another book that you can share with us?
I do have another book that I want to share, or more precisely, actually, a movie, a script that was made into a movie that I highly recommend, and it is called The Life of Others. It's a movie about surveillance in East Germany in the 1970s. But that's only the front story. The back story is about the surveyors and the surveyed, the ethics and moral questions of surveillance, of those that bug private apartments of citizens and listen in on conversations, and vexing questions that are being posed by a surveillance society. It's a wonderful, slow but gripping story, and it won the Oscar 2 years back.
Victor Mayer Schoenberger, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Thank you, Barry, for having me.
In conversation with a group of friends, after interviewing Victor Mayer Schoenberger, author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age, someone commented that our conversation sounded like Ludditeism and bore a negative tone towards maintaining digital records. it occurred to me to contact Victor Mayer Schoenberger and asked him if he would comment both on what I felt might have been perhaps a Luddite or negative tone regarding digital memory in our interviews and the positive benefits of digital remembering. He did comment and responded as follows. Yes, Ludditism is on the rise, and I'm not happy about that. Even President Obama, when visiting a school last fall, advised that pupils should carefully self-censor what they post on Facebook or Twitter, as it may come to haunt them much later in life. But a world of self-censoring humans takes much of the value out of the information sharing tools we have developed and are available on the internet that can foster innovation and advance governance. Self-censorship also impoverishes the robust give and take of public debate we need for our society to thrive. That is why, in Delete, I deliberately do not argue for digital abstinence. Instead, I suggest we continue to use the information sharing opportunities even more, from Facebook to Twitter to data.gov, but add expiration dates as a mechanism to curb negative effects of sharing in the longer run. We thus replicate some of the ephemeral nature of oral communication in real life. This, I believe, wrote Victor Mayer Schoenberger, is the key to move forward. Victor Mayer Schoenberger is the author of Delete, The Virtue of Forgetting in the Digital Age. The book he recommends is The Collected Fictions of Jorge Luis Borges. This conversation was recorded on January 4, 2010. There are over 500 archive editions of Radio Curious on our website, www.radiocurious.org, where they're free for you to stream, download, enjoy, and share. We appreciate your curiosity, ideas, comments, and questions. You may reach us by email. Our address is curious@radiocurious.org or snailmail 280 North Oak Street, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California 95482, or by phone 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. Christina Onnestad is our associate producer, and I'm host and producer, Barry Vogel. Thank you for listening.
Monday, August 18th at 6:30 p.m., join KBOO at the Clinton for a screening of Woodstock, the director's cut. This landmark concert film is the definitive record of that three-day cultural event. Director Michael Wadley worked with over 300 hours of footage to create his original 225-minute director's cut. Again, that's Woodstock, the director's cut at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
How I'd love to wander back.
Hi there, this is Rita Christie, host of the Noontime Jamboree on the first and third Monday of each month. Please join me for vintage jazz, country, and western swing. That's on the Noontime Jamboree, the first and third Mondays from noon until 2 p.m. right here on KBOO.
You're listening to KBOO Portland. I'm Don Jacobson. Moving on, we'll be here right after the noon headlines.
Yes, it's time for the KBOO News at Noon for Friday, August 8th. I'm Kristen Yount. Marcellus Shale Natural Gas Development in Pennsylvania topped out last month. The nonprofit group Earthworks released a report entitled Blackout on the Gas Patch, How Pennsylvania Residents Are Left in the Dark on Health and Enforcement. The report claims that 83% of wells in the state were never tested, and that residents bear the burden of reporting and proving that their water has been compromised. It also says that the Department of Environmental Protection cannot accurately answer questions or concerns about water quality and corroborates a report from the state's Auditor General last month that Pennsylvania's DEP can't both manage drilling operations and protect consumers' water. In Washington County, southwest of Pittsburgh, wastewater from at least three hydraulic fracturing endeavors by Range Resources Incorporated has leaked, putting between two and six towns in jeopardy. Starting on October 1st, businesses in Massachusetts that yield more than one ton of leftover foodstuffs in a week must either donate them, send them to a composting facility, feedlot, or an anaerobic digestion plant that uses microbes to turn organic material into biogas. Vermont and Connecticut also banned some usable food scraps from going into landfills. Biogas can be converted into electricity or used to fuel vehicles. Seven mayors, 18 city council members, councilors, commissioners, and state lawmakers from Albany to the Dalles sent word to Governor Kitzhaber and the Oregon Transportation Commission to stop state funding to expand coal and oil train use in Oregon in a letter yesterday. The letter restates concern expressed over coal export terminals on the coast or in the gorge presented back in May. Ombre Energy and Global Partners submitted Connect Oregon 5 grant applications for state funding to expand the speed and number of fossil fuel rail operations in the region and to fund a new berth at Port Westward Dock in Rainier, Oregon. The group, citing their constituents, wants Kitzhaber to deny the applications to the company. The letter states that